Beaver Island lies about 32 miles off the coast of Michigan, smack dab in the middle of the two peninsulas. Its population of 657 people have a total of 8 restaurants to choose from. But that's really only during the summer, because it's the type of place that largely shuts down when the tourists don't want to come visit. It's a quiet, peaceful island, wholly unremarkable as a vacation destination today. But for 6 whole years in the 1850s, this island and its people, they had themselves a king. I'm Corey Constable, and this is Omitted. James Jesse Strang would have celebrated his 204th birthday just a couple of weeks ago. Born on March 21, 1813, in Scipio, New York, he was the middle child of a respected family in a tiny town built for Revolutionary War veterans. He attended school there, or at least tried to, but his poor health and his wandering mind made traditional study impossible. When he dropped out at the age of 12, his teachers deemed him a lost cause. Another wayward child born for the farm, without any hope for a life of grandeur. But that hope was alive in James Strang. You can find it in his journal, through his preoccupation with the great men of history, and his desire to, quote, rival Caesar or Napoleon. In one such passage, he actually states, "I have spent the day in trying to contrive some plan of obtaining in marriage the heir to the English crown. It is a difficult business for me, but I shall try if there is the least chance. My mind has always been filled with dreams of royalty and power." And although the odds were slim that Princess Elizabeth might someday marry a farm boy from New York, just the thought, the idea that he considered it possible, says a lot about the mindset he held. At the age of 19, with his goals not progressing, he lamented in his journal, "I am yet no more than a common farmer." And then a year later, he wrote, 20 years of my life are already past, and what have I done? Nothing. Nothing." Obscurity, he felt, was a fate worse than death itself, but how to gain the notoriety he desired so badly, he hadn't quite yet figured out. He decided, at one point, to pursue a career in law, but then he dropped it, which is a shame because that could have been exactly what he needed to pursue the career in politics, which he also considered. He then tried his hand at teaching, but that didn't work out either. With only 7 students in the Randolph School, he grew bored and more frustrated with his community. And all the while, through all these life troubles, he continued to write in his journal. At times he used a code, a cipher he'd made up so no one else could read his true intentions. And on May 29, 1836, when he was 23 years old, Strang reached the final page. "I have commenced the last page with 1,000 things to write, but no cash to purchase another book." He was broke, penniless, completely downtrodden, and still not sure what to do. But then shortly thereafter, he heard word of a man who would change his life forever. On September 22, 1823, when James Strang was only 10 years old, a treasure hunter named Joseph Smith was visited in the night by someone unexpected. An angel named Moroni appeared in his home while he was saying his evening prayers and directed him out toward a hill. "Here," the angel told him, "you'll find buried a box that holds the word of God given especially unto you." He tried to dig up the box, but the angel stopped him and told him to return in a year. So Smith did, but was stopped once more. On his 4th attempt, Moroni conceded, and Smith returned home to his wife with a heavy box that held contents he couldn't show anyone. In the box, he was told, is the Word of God, written on plates in Reformed Egyptian. He couldn't read them with untrained eyes, but the pair of spectacles in the box would reveal its secrets. Smith eventually allowed 11 other men to see the plates to confirm what he'd found. These men, you might have guessed by now, were later called the Book of Mormon Witnesses. When he'd finished transcribing the text on the plates, he published them as a sacred book. The plates, he says, were returned to Moroni, so they cannot be witnessed today. Now, I'm not here to debate the veracity of the claims that Joseph Smith put forward. Who am I to say? Rather than dwell on the theology of the religion, I'm more interested in the story that followed. On March 26, 1830, Joseph Smith published the Book of Mormon. And 11 days later, on April 6th, the Latter-day Saints held their first church service. The men who gathered there began spreading the word about this new prophet and the message he was preaching, and slowly, they began to build a following. While passing through Kirtland, Ohio, on their way to Missouri, some of Smith's men found a church. By the end of the evening, with the preacher's participation, the entire congregation of 100 people had converted to Mormonism. Within 4 years, nearly 2,000 Mormons had flooded into the Kirtland area. Their communalism was a disruption to the local economy, and their religious beliefs were just different enough to cause tension. When the non-Mormons in the town had finally reached their limit, they captured Smith and his partner, beat them unconscious, and proceeded to tar and feather them. At this point, the Mormons continued westward, eventually settling again in Jackson County, Missouri. This place, Smith declared, was the center of Zion, the site of the Garden of Eden. The neighbors, however, weren't quite as convinced, and once again, the Mormons were run out of town. At this point, they crossed the Mississippi once more and bought out a town in Illinois named Commerce. They renamed it Nauvoo and began building their community, and the doctrine of the Mormon Church began to take root. By the time Nauvoo was founded, James Strang was living in Wisconsin with his new wife, Mary. They had moved out west where he had family, hoping new opportunities would present themselves in this largely unexplored land. And in 1843, at a fiery and impassioned church service, Strang heard news of what was happening down south. Word had spread that a prophet had moved his congregation to Illinois and founded a church that was garnering power. This, of course, was an attractive idea. That a man from out east had built up a following, had declared himself the president of an entire religion, that was an idea that resonated in James Strang's mind. So he packed a bag, strapped it onto his horse, kissed Mary goodbye, and set out to Nauvoo to find for himself whether the word from that service was true. In January of 1844, the men met for the first time, and Strang sized up the prophet immediately. He was short, with reddish-brown hair. He didn't seem as well-learned, and he certainly didn't have the speaking skills that James prided himself on. In just about every way, James Strang felt, Joseph Smith was inferior. The only thing that set him apart, that put him on a higher pedestal, was this thing, this religion he'd built. Worldly qualities aside, that alone was enough to command Strang's respect. The men took a liking to each other fairly quickly, and by the end of the month, James Strang was all in for the Mormon faith. He was baptized on February 25th by the prophet himself, and was ordained as an elder only 8 days later. Smith told Strang of the troubles that were brewing in Nauvoo, of the backlash from the non-Mormon community who found these new strangers and their faith to be disruptive. He knew they would have to move again, but to where, he couldn't decide. "I will return home," Strang told him, and put together a report to arrange for the transfer of the congregation to Burlington, Wisconsin. Smith agreed to hear him out, and Strang went on his way. Less than 3 months later, the situation in Nauvoo came to a head. Joseph Smith had vowed to run as a third-party candidate for the presidency, and the church began preaching that unjust laws, written to repress their God-given rights, should be ignored. That polygamy, for one, was the rightful way of life on earth, and that no government could stop them. Following debates on how to manage Nauvoo's economy, the church was split and the two different factions began working against each other. The opposing faction began its own church and had Smith arrested for polygamy and perjury. And sensing the vulnerability, non-Mormon members of the community seized the opportunity to put this whole thing to a rest. They stormed the prison in Carthage, Illinois, where Joseph Smith was being held. Smith tried to escape, but there wasn't any hope. "O Lord my God," he cried as he fell out the window of the prison, with gunshot wounds peppering his back. Word of the assassination reached James Strang shortly afterward, and in the scramble that followed to elect a new leader, his was one of the dozen or so names that was tossed around as an option. This was his chance. This was his opportunity. The thing he'd been waiting for all his life. He turned over some letters to his fellow church elders. They were written in neat handwriting by a fountain pen, and bore the signature of Joseph Smith. These were his letters of appointment, Strang argued. This was all the proof he needed that Smith had been planning to appoint him as the new leader. He hoped, and he prayed, that the elders wouldn't notice that the signature on page 3 looked nothing like the others the prophet had penned in his lifetime. But just to add to the certainty that he was the church's rightful heir, he claimed he was visited on September 1st by an angel of God, and you can probably guess what followed. The angel directed him toward a patch of land beneath an oak tree, where 3 feet down, Strang found buried a set of gold tablets and the lenses he would need to read them. These tablets, like the first set, were confirmed by a group of elders, and feeling that this was a sign from above, people began making the 200-mile trip north from Nauvoo to join him. This man, Strang, they felt, seemed to uphold the great values of their former leader. He took a principled approach, but was pragmatic enough to understand that polygamy had been the biggest source of contention. He opposed it, for that reason, and made clear that polygamy would never be accepted by his church or his congregation, who called themselves Strangites. But then in 1849, it seems he had a change of heart, although no one can say for certain why. Polygamy, he decided, was the natural order of the world. It's what God wanted, and whatever God wanted, the church should obey. He began practicing polygamy himself at this time. On July 13, 1849, he took his second wife, a 19-year-old named Elvira, and not quite ready to announce his new bride, he dressed her in men's clothing and introduced her as his nephew, Charlie Douglas. This decision tore apart his congregation, which by this point numbered nearly 2,000. It stirred up trouble among the non-Mormon locals. Polygamy, be it ordained by God or not, was an unpopular position, and Strang was faced with the same problem that Smith had encountered. He knew that, like Smith, he would have to change location. So in 1850, he uprooted his church and set out for Beaver Island. We can't quite be sure why he chose this place to be the center of his new religion. But if I had to guess, it's isolation, its exclusion from the pressures of the outside world, surely had something to do with it. Even today, the portions of the Mormon Church that still practice polygamy do so in locations that are isolated from government involvement. The fundamentalists in Arizona, for example, are able to get away with their actions because their strip of land is cut off from the rest of the state. The only way to get to them is by passing through Nevada or Utah, which poses legal problems for law enforcement. So this island, Strang must have thought, would be perfectly removed from the troubles that outsiders and the law might bring. But just to be sure that there would be no legal trouble, he ran for and won a seat in the Michigan House of Representatives. Everything seemed to be working out perfectly for James Strang. The troubles and misdirection of his early 20s seemed a world away from the life he now lived. With his own island, a political title, 5 wives, and a following of nearly 3,000 people who viewed him as a prophet, he had finally reached the sort of lifestyle and power he'd always dreamed he'd have. But as is so often the case among people who desire power, he began to abuse it. In 1850, in front of a crowd of 300, he donned a red flannel robe topped with a white collar, and a tin crown was placed upon his head. He'd had a vision from God that the kingdom of heaven would begin its reign right there on Beaver Island, and he, James Strang, was to be its true leader. His followers called him their king, and he ruled over his subjects with what can only be described as an iron fist. He outlawed liquor and adultery, and regardless of whether or not an individual actually partook in either, if they found themselves on the king's bad side, they were accused and beaten with tree branches. And then in 1855, after 5 years under the reign of their new king, it was decided that the women of Beaver Island would be required to wear bloomers as their undergarments. If this seems like an arbitrary decision, that's because it is. To date, I've been unable to find any reason why this edict was ever created. But of all of the laws that would lead to the end of his reign, I doubt he ever thought that this would be the one. 2 women within his community refused to comply with the bloomer law. This bothered Strang, so he had their husbands punished. Thomas Bedford was one of the men who was flogged for his wife's stubbornness. And when Strang left the island for a trip to the city, Bedford began to formulate a plan. But he wasn't alone in his hatred for the king. By this point, their religious leader had taken on the approach of a despot, and many within the community were sick of his edicts, tired of the authoritarian approach he held over them. On June 18, 1856, the USS Michigan was docked at Beaver Island's harbor. As the king walked up the gangway to board the ship, Thomas Bedford and Alexander Wentworth snuck up behind him. They pulled out the pistols they'd been practicing with, and they shot James Strang 3 times. As he collapsed onto the gangway with a bullet lodged in his spine, the men sprinted past him onto the ship. And although everyone aboard the USS Michigan that evening had been watching the king's approach, not a single one of them took a second to warn him, and none of them walked down the gangway to help. Bedford and Wentworth were taken aboard the ship and transported to Mackinac Island. Beaver Island's sheriff wanted the men, but the captain refused to hand them over. They were tried in court, given a fine of $1.25 each, and sent on their way with praise from the community. But James Strang held on for 3 more weeks. He was taken aboard a boat to Vory, Wisconsin, the community that he'd once helped set up, then abandoned. Paralyzed from the waist down, he was bedridden for the remainder of his life, until he died on July 9, 1856. And with him died the hope for Beaver Island. 4 days prior to his death, the island was invaded by a group of men from Mackinac. The houses were plundered and destroyed, and the 2,600 Strangites who still lived there were forcibly removed from their homes, sent on their way about the country. A small group of Strangites still exists today, though, based in Independence, Missouri and Shreveport, Louisiana. In true Mormon fashion, there's a lot of debate between them as to which sect of the church is legitimate. The King of Beaver Island has a story larger than life, but it's not quite one that's well known. Looking back on his journal, I have to wonder if he achieved the goals he set out for. Did he ever, in his lifetime, rival Caesar or Napoleon? I would argue no, because otherwise I wouldn't have felt inclined to tell you his story today. James Strang suffered that fate that was worse than death itself. His name has truly been omitted.